Donc, on va passer à la prochaine communication. C'est donc de Madame Roxane Margariti qui va nous parler de la mer Rouge. Madame Margariti est professeure à l'université d'Emory aux États-Unis. Elle a été donc formée en Angleterre, puis à Princeton, où elle a étudié justement les réseaux de commerce de la Guenisa, dont je viens de parler, et notamment dans un livre important intitulé Aden and the Indian Ocean Trade, Aden et le commerce de l'océan Indien, 150 Years in the Life of a Medieval Arabian Port. Elle a aussi édité deux volumes en honneur de Mark Cohen et d'Avram Widowich, tous les deux ses professeurs à Princeton, justement. Et aujourd'hui, elle va nous parler donc de son nouveau projet portant sur les îles dans la mer Rouge au XVIe siècle, pour l'essentiel, je crois.
XVIe. La parole est à vous. Merci beaucoup. Thank you so much for this introduction. And thank you for having me. It's great to be among so many kinesiologists here. Je vais vous transporter maintenant de la Méditerranée à l'océan Indien, et d'un archipel, de l'archipel de Majorque, à un autre archipel, l'archipel de Dakhlak, qu'on voit ici. Voilà. Et je dois le faire en anglais. Je m'excuse pour ça et je dois demander pour votre patience. Alors, what I will present today is a history of the Dakhlak Archipelago, a group of islands in the southern Red Sea, in the territorial waters of Eritrea. This history is a book project that I hope to complete this year, and it attempts to understand the lives of the Dakhlak Islanders between the 10th and the 17th century, and how these lives connected with histories of better known states in the region and with better known social and economic networks. So this, in essence, is an attempt to do the view from the islands or from the islanders' perspective, to counter, to some extent, the imaginary of islands that Professor Subramaniam talked to us so eloquently about. So here my focus will be particularly the transition between the medieval and the early modern, how things change for islanders and the role of islands through the 16th and 17th centuries. In this period, Red Sea islands and their islanders stood at the margins of expansive polities and dynasties. The Fatimids and the Mamluks of Egypt and Syria, the Ziyadids, the Sulayhids, the Rasulids and the Tahirids of Yemen, the Zagwe and the Solomonid Christian dynasties of Ethiopia, and then the Ottomans and the Portuguese Estado da India. But marginal as they may seem from that perspective, islands and islanders also occupied many crossroads. It is the intersection between the local, the regional, and the global aspects of the island experience that I try to capture in this biography of the Dakhlak Archipelago. Much like my colleague who just spoke to us so richly about the different networks of the Majorcan polity and traders. I'm also interested in how we can write the history of a place and a time that did not have its own historians or its own cartographers. So the pearls in my title stands for the environmental and the commercial dimensions of this inquiry, and the forts stands for political history. To set the stage, allow me to start with a story. According to island legend, Dakhlak Kabir, the main island of the Dakhlak Archipelago, once had a king, and that king had a beautiful daughter. The island princess was of marrying age, and sons of kings came to ask for her hand. The royal father deferred to his daughter, and the girl set her suitors a double challenge. "By God," she said, "we have a water problem here. I would marry anyone who digs for me 360 water tanks. We also have pirates roaming the seas and coveting the king's riches in livestock. I would also marry someone who produces a lion to scare off the pirates." Two young princes went to work, one digging wells, the other sculpting a lion, each rushing to finish his task first and to earn the island princess's hand in marriage. In the end, the maker of water tanks won the contest and the prize, while the sculptor of the stone lion, which refused to be finished, drowned in the sea. The story was told in Dahalic, the archipelago's distinct language, and was ethnographically recorded in recent years. It was included in an ethnolinguistic study by Salah Mahmoud Idris, a comparative study of Tigre dialects published in Aachen in 2015. And according to him, Dahalic is one of several Tigre dialects of modern-day Eritrea and Sudan. But in comparison to the other variants of that South Semitic Ethiopic language, Dahalic is, quote, "the most divergent variety and deserves to be treated separately," end of quote. Marie-Claude Simeon Senel, here at the CNRS, is more declarative in identifying Dahalic as a separate language. And I will return to this question of a distinct island language and what that means for island history at the end of the talk. In addition to all that language signifies, the legend of the pretty and pragmatic princess encapsulates with stunningly focused precision some basic ingredients of these Red Sea islands' distant and little known, hitherto hidden history. What are these ingredients? First, the king. The king of the story echoes the sovereigns of a little-known Muslim principality based at the archipelago from at least as early as the 10th century and further. The existence of this polity is attested in fleeting mentions in classical Arabic historical and geographical texts. And I give you here a map that is here at the Bibliothèque Nationale from the 10th century that shows us the island of Dahlak right there, produced somewhere in the Levant. It is also attested in Judeo-Arabic letters, the Geniza letters that Professor Subramaniam mentioned and Professor Hussein Mishenzis showed us the language of Judeo-Arabic in which they are written, and they come from Jewish merchants who passed through the islands to do trade, and here the text shows us a not very routine, the experience of a shipwreck, but a shipwreck that had a happy conclusion and that was that ended in rescue, partly thanks to island intervention. It is also more directly attested by a series of tombstones belonging to the extensive site of Dahlak Kabir and bearing the names of men who construed themselves as sultans of the island. Again, this is the archaeological site right here. A plan of the last survey, archaeological survey done on the island in 1996 by Timothy Insall. You see the cemeteries, the settlement here, and cemeteries surrounding those settlements. Dwellings made of coral rock, the remains of a domed tomb, a larger tomb at Dahlak, remains of surface finds that point to connections transregionally, including some Chinese pottery, which was a major trade commodity of the era, but also remains of objects made on the island. the remains of the cemetery, and a corpus of over 250 tombstones. This one you see here is on in situ. They were beautifully published by Madeleine Schneider in the 1980s, and it is in these tombstones that we find the names of kings of the islands that call themselves sultans. So that's the first part of the story. Second, the successful prince's 360 water tanks clearly refer to the many cisterns located around the main ancient site of Dakhlak Kebir. These were archaeologically recorded, and their date is uncertain, but they constitute one of the many traces of human engagement with a strategically located and biologically rich, yet climatically extreme environment. Similar installations have been found at sites all along the Red Sea coasts and the islands of the Arabian and East African littorals. Third, the figure of the stone lion and the failed bid of its purveyor strongly resonate with the connection between the islands and the East African mainland across the water, and more broadly with regional history, both environmental and political. Felines and other large animals from the neighboring mainland served as prestige gifts for monarchs far afield in ancient and medieval times, and were recorded and collected by the first modern naturalists to visit so-called Abyssinia in the late 18th and early 19th century. Also, Ethiopian kings, who have long associated their kingship with the Lion of Judah as a potent symbol of religious and earthly supremacy, were at times the real or aspiring overlords of the maritime realm in the southern Red Sea, which in turn variously accepted or evaded their rule. But there is also ample evidence of interdependence or even friendly or at least symbiotic relations between highland Christian institutions and Muslim islands in medieval times. In the 14th century, for example, one of the most important monastic foundations of the Ethiopian church, Debra Bizan, located between the highlands and foothills leading to the coast, but what is modern-day Eritrea, apparently had contacts and exchanges of trading privileges with the Dahlakis. We find this in the acts of the founder of the Bizan monastery. The work is called Gadla Philpos. In other words, in the figure of the lion, the legend conveys the ambivalent relationship of the islands with Christian Ethiopia. Finally, the pirates. Medieval authors and modern historians alike have presented those early kings of Dakhlak as thieves of the high seas. While the island rulers called themselves sultans, chroniclers and travelers called them by the Arabic word sahib, which denotes simply de facto power, but not the right to rule or the right to sovereignty. Harassment and interception of maritime traffic is another accusation that is leveled against medieval Dahlaki strongmen in outsider sources, such as Mamluk chroniclers. Makrizi gives us stories about ships being intercepted by the rulers of Dakhlak. And this is another strand that passes uninterrogated from the sparse medieval reports to modern historiography. These people were pirates, simply put. As we see in the legend of the Dakhlaki princess, however, from the point of view of the islanders themselves, the arrows of maritime predation in the region run in the opposite direction. For them, the predators were precisely those outsiders threatening island maritime turf. This little gem of a story thus seems to reveal a contemporary vernacular understanding of how island geography, environment, sovereignty, and security were interwoven in the past. We might even say that it constitutes a piece of local history, or at least a refracted memory of the archipelago's biography. More surely, it provokes us to think how the reality of islandness And the notions of insularity have factored in the course of medieval and early modern history at the Dahlak Archipelago and the Red Sea as a whole. In the process of examining this dual historical phenomenon, meaning the actual island condition and the ideas about insularity, the imaginary of insularity that we heard about earlier, several themes emerge. And here I would like to focus on two that appear to me to be crucial in puzzling out the changing roles of islands in the early modern period, at least in this case. One is the particularly maritime dimension of human interaction with the environment, and the other is the participation of island potentates in political networks here of the Red Sea, of the Horn of Africa, of Arabia, and the Indian Ocean more broadly. So first, on the distinct maritime environment of the islands, a constant but not immutable part of the history of this and other archipelago. There's a lot of work recently about the environmental changes that took place in the 16th and 17th century through a climatic period that is termed the Little Ice Age and the onset of different environmental conditions. And in fact, Michel Touchard, who has written an article, an early article on insularity in the Red Sea, had pointed to this and to make us conscious of the fact that the very extreme conditions that prevail today were not necessarily the ones that were obtaining in medieval and early modern times. So as the pearls in my title attempts to signal, marine resources and island history and the islanders' expert control over maritime space played a crucial role in island and non-island history, constituting a particular kind of sea and land realm, what I call, borrowing from archaeological literature on islands, a maritory. The particular configuration of the archipelagic space occupied by the Dahlakis shaped in part the ways in which the islanders managed available resources, how they landed their catch, dealt with water scarcity, or grazed their cattle. Maritime topography and marine resources also played a central role in the modes of islanders' interactions with outsiders. With command of maritime transportation technology, navigational expertise, and specialized knowledge of marine and littoral topography and biology, influencing the outcomes of these interactions to a large degree. The central strand in the islanders' connections to their distant forelands was exchange, both gift-giving, just mentioned, and we'll see a little more about it, and trans-regional maritime trade. To networks of merchants crisscrossing the Red Sea in medieval times, the archipelago supplied shipping havens, victual supplies, market and maritime services like the rescue mission that saved the merchant we saw earlier, and rare local commodities, including pearls. And allow me to be even more specific. Ranging from the very large Dahlak Kabir in the center there, big Dahlak, to the very tiny, the islands are low-lying coral formations sitting on geological salt domes that give them their distinct maritime topography. A maze of navigable passages and dead ends, shallows and landing places that are spread over 3,000 square kilometers and required considerable local knowledge to navigate in the pre-modern period and up to recently as a number of shipwrecks in the area demonstrate. Here we have the single pre-modern shipwreck to have been excavated. It is carrying 6th century amphorae on a little island south of the main site. And here we have the several shipwrecks that have been identified of the 20th century in addition to this earlier one. So a lot of shipwrecks and local knowledge of navigating this water is being very, very central. The broad and shallow continental shelf, The broad and shallow continental shelf at this point of the Red Sea means increased evaporation and high temperatures, among other ecological effects that make for a notoriously harsh climate today. In spite of this, the island's biodiversity is still remarkable and includes a variety of unique and uniquely maritime resources of significant economic value, both to the traditional modes of subsistence of the islanders and to cross-regional trade in the past, as far as we can trace glimpses of it in the sources. There is mangrove and coral, both of which made important construction materials, as witnessed by the remains of the walls of the houses of that archaeological site that we saw earlier. Food resources include fish, mollusks, holothurians, and a phenomenal variety of bird species. Also sea turtles, which also can be found in some of the medieval sources. Finally, and most importantly for transregional trade, there is ambergris, tortoiseshell, and pearls renowned since antiquity. And here comes now a specimen of that, a pearl from the archipelago found in the mainland site of Adulis, across the water from the islands at the Bay of Zula, that participated in the trade between the Roman Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean world in the first century. Dahlaki pearls are cataloged in Abu Rayhan al-Biruni's famous lapidary, Kitab al-Jamahir fi Ma'arifat al-Jawahir, the Book of Useful Knowledge on Jewels. He describes them as lead-colored and fetching moderate prices in the markets of Mecca. The economic exploitation of the Dahlaki pearl banks appears as a constant theme in the history of the region early on. The great late medieval historian Ibn Khaldun reports that in the 9th century, the sovereign of Yemen, Abul Jais bin Ziyad, claimed to control the revenues from those pearl banks. And as we shall see, the Ottomans and the Portuguese too noticed and commented on the Dahlaki pearl industry, if we can call it that. This recognition by outsiders of pearls as a commodity is a dynamic that persists through the transformations that took place in the early modern period. In fact, state and non-state interest in control of pearl diving was important again in the 19th and 20th century, as a upcoming book by Jonathan Miran will show. He's a scholar who has studied the mainland port of Massawa across the water in the 19th century. Red Sea pearls never rivaled Gulf pearls as commodities of transregional trade, either in the medieval and still less in the early modern period, where coffee quickly came to dominate the Red Sea commodities complex. But pearls featured episodically as a lure for interlopers, while pearl banks were a consistently prominent fact in the livelihoods of Red Sea people, particularly the islanders. This brings me to the second theme of pearls and forts, which is politics. Commerce and economy was a force that connected the Dahlaks and the southern Red Sea to forelands in East Africa and Arabia, in Egypt and India, the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean. Political and even military history is of the essence too. Between the 10th and the 13th century, the Fatimid and then the Ayyubid dynasties, from their seat in Cairo, sent not only traders, but also missionaries, soldiers, and diplomats to the polities holding on to different parts of Yemen and Ethiopia. And in response, the Dahlakis not only purveyed maritime and market services, but also played a delicate political game. The game unfolded in the context of the so-called Sunni resurgence in the central lands of Islam. Generally called the Sunni resurgence, that culminated with the demise of the last great Ismaili Shia dynasty of the Middle Ages, the Fatimids, in the second half of the 12th century. Aligning themselves with the trend of the time, Dahlaki leaders assumed rather grandiose titles of Islamic political legitimacy. This included the title of Sultan itself, first sported by the sovereigns of the expansive Ghaznavid, Ghaznavid and then Seljuk states as well as other explicitly Islamic epithets of Islamically meritorious leadership. Nasir al-Islam, Victor of Islam, Aiz al-Islam wal-Muslimin, Victor of Islam and the Muslims, Al-Faghri al-Islami, the border defender of Islam. All of these titles occur in the tombstones of the sovereigns of this archipelago. All part of a developing 12th century coiny or common language of governing in which the Dahlaki Sultan saw fit to participate. From the 13th to the 15th century, the ruling Mamluks of Egypt and the Levant and the Rasulids of Yemen, locked in a contest for control over parts of the Red Sea, received prestigious gifts from the islands, elephants, giraffes, pearls, and in addition to that, enslaved people are also included in the lists of gifts received on either side of this regional network. And the history of the slave trade and of slave labor, in fact, deserves a separate chapter in the history of these islands. Mamluk sultans in Egypt grumbled about the treatment received by their merchants in the waters of the archipelago. Both they and the Rasulid sultans of Yemen at times projected claims of sovereignty over the islands. Overall, the relations between islanders and non-islanders through the medieval centuries could be characterized as accommodation and symbiosis, laced with competition and episodic conflict. The discursive sources produced in metropolitan centers construe the island as marginal, and its kings, its rulers as petty kings, but also show how these metropolitan centers benefited from the natural resources and trade networks that passed through the islands, receiving gifts and using the islands as stepping stones. Conversely, the rhetoric of the tombstones project the local potentate's strategic participation in diffuse notions of Islamic legitimacy and thereby in regional and transregional politics. The view from the islands thus exposes limits, the limits of control that these larger states exercised at their margins and beyond, and the nature and intersection of trading and political networks at a multiple maritime and insular edge. Then, after a noticeable and intriguing hiatus in the documentary and narrative record in the 15th century, the 16th century brings about the reappearance of Dahlak on both physical and mental maps of outsiders. So in the time that I have left, I will attempt to summarize the evidence and comment on the differences between these two periods. Part of a new vision of universal empire evinced by both the Portuguese and the Ottomans, as recently, most recently argued by Giancarlo Casale and as seen earlier in the works of Cengiz Orhonlu and Salih Özbaran. The methods and structures of state intervention in the Southern Red Sea during the rise of the Ottoman Imperium and its clash with the nascent seaborne empire of the Portuguese contrasts with earlier modes of engagement between larger states and small maritime polities, as it does in the entire region of the Indian Ocean. Excavating and understanding the ways in which the small Dahlak polity reacted to these new interlopers, the study of the little-known maritime state at the margins of major states and empires could shed significant new light on the geopolitical dynamics of the era described by Professor Subramaniam as an age of contained conflict, referring to the relations between Europeans and South Asians in India and South Asia in general. What was the conflict like in the Southern Red Sea? How did it differ from the earlier dynamics? What role did islands play in it? And if we may ask, what did it mean for the lives of the islanders? Analysis of a variety of cartographic renditions of the Dahlak Archipelago and examination of the geographical texts collected and used in the context of the so-called Ottoman Age of Exploration dramatically illustrate new interest in islands on the part of outsiders. And these are texts, many of them classical medieval Arabic geographical texts and travel texts that were collected in Istanbul and formed part of the knowledge bases that to some extent informed the Ottoman cartographic project. Conversely, the islanders' response is much more difficult to demonstrate, as narrative histories are written, obviously, from outsider perspectives and often concern two basic things which could be summarized as pearls and forts. I will try to give you a taste of the range of evidence emanating from the participants of the new, if we can call them that, geopolitics of the Red Sea, Dahlaki, Portuguese, and Ottomans, all of which attest to the re-emergence of the Dahlak Islands in the narrative of political history in the 16th century. So first, the view from the islands. The last known tombstone from Dahlak, the last dated one, is also the tombstone of a Dahlaki potentate. And I should say here that this epigraphic record of these over 250 tombstones is dispersed in museums in modern-day Eritrea, in Egypt, in Italy, Modena, and here is also an example here in France at the Museum of Bar-le-Duc. So the epigraphic record really ends with a bang, because this tombstone represents, in fact, two Dahlaki sultans, the person named as the deceased, Ahmed, and his father, whose own name, Ismail, predictably appears in the nasab, in the genealogy of the deceased. The wording is deliberate and emphatic. The Sultan Ahmed, son of the Sultan Ismail. This is followed by an even more explicit argument about the importance of these men in the form of the epithets used to characterize Sultan Ahmed. He is al-Murabbid, the defender of the frontier of Islam, and al-Mujahid, the warrior for Islam. Remember that the last sultans on the tombstones of the islands had appeared in the 12th century in the context of the demise of the last Shia medieval state and the resurgence of Sunnism around the Red Sea. Here the context was different, and so was the impetus for the Dahlaki rulers sporting these titles of Islamic borderland defense. In a way, they were capitalizing on the notion of frontiers and hard lines, while at the same time participating in their very fluidity. And this concept of frontiers is crucial for the nature of frontiers is crucial for this history. Since 1513, when Alfonso de Albuquerque had first entered the Red Sea and briefly occupied Kamaran Island, which is across from the Dahlak Islands on the Yemeni shore, the archipelago, the Dahlak archipelago, appears to have featured prominently in the newcomers' strategic plans. Jean Gomez reconnoitered the archipelago and the nearby important port of Massawa, and this expedition produced the earliest 16th century outsider description of the island. The main settlement of Dahlak Kabir is described as thickly inhabited, and the local potentate, the Sheikh is how he's called in Jean Gomez's account, as commanding an entourage of 100 men. So there is an ambivalent relationship with the local potentates. Portuguese interest proved to be sustained. In 1517, another expedition came to the archipelago, seeking an alliance with the Dahlakis, but the result was an ambush and the killing of three Portuguese soldiers. In 1520, a new Portuguese foray into the Red Sea proceeded to Dahlak, found the place empty, burned some of the houses of the port city, presumably in revenge for the earlier offense. And finally, in 1541, shortly after the death of the last attested Dahlaki sultan, another, perhaps the last Portuguese foray in the archipelago. This time, it was part of a mission to land a returning embassy to the Christian kings of Ethiopia, of the Ethiopian highlands, to aid Christian Ethiopians against the Muslim Sultan of Adal, Ahmed Grany, and to push to the extreme north of the Red Sea in exploration. Getting to the port of Massawa to land the embassy, and Massawa is right there, and really becomes quite important from this period on. So getting to that port to land the embassy, the Portuguese embassy to the Ethiopian highlands, meant passing through, but not necessarily stopping in the islands, except that, again, the Portuguese intense interest for both the navigational and political reasons is manifest in the surviving records. In his famous description of the entire endeavor, Jean de Castro speaks in minute detail of the marine topography here and the sailing channels. But he also speaks quite a bit of the king of Dalakwa, how he spells it, whom he clearly did not manage to make direct contact with. The king of the island is of Arab race, as is the entire population. This is a quote from de Castro's Roteiro. He spends most of the year at Massawa, which since he trades with the Abyssinians, and he can only do that from there, end of quote. The Dahlaki king has taken over the coastal mainland, the ports of Massawa and Arkiko, according to Jean, and he and the population would retire to the islands in the summer when the heat of the mainland becomes unbearable. So that's the Portuguese take on the Dahlaki's command of space here. The Portuguese-Ottoman context is the tense, conflictual scene in which to understand the titles of Islamically meritorious leadership assumed by the island sovereigns. At the same time, the Portuguese failed attempts to pin down a local ally with whom to negotiate in their bid to make a territorial bridge with highland Christian Ethiopia. The descriptions of elusive islanders and of island and coast dominions signal something more constant in the history of the archipelago. We are here again confronting the real and enduring significance of the islands as part of, and often the heart of, a land and sea realm, a meritory crucial to the connected histories of local and global forces. Turning finally to the Ottoman material, I draw your attention to two very different texts that I think summarize some of the main threads of the ambitions, limitations, and outcomes of Ottoman presence in the Red Sea. These are an official report by a sea captain in the early days of the Ottoman engagement in the Red Sea, and a travel account of the much-admired Ottoman traveler Evliya Çelebi about a century later. So 1525 is the first document, 1670s, early 1670s is the second, the travel account. So the first, Salman Reis was a Rumi, an Anatolian seafarer and old Red Sea hand who had fought for the Mamluks against the early encroachments of the Portuguese in the beginning of the 16th century in the Red Sea and as far as the western coast of India. In the 1520s, he was newly entrusted with intelligence gathering for the Ottomans, and as part of his mission, he's thought to have authored a 1525 report preserved at the Topkapi, which is, quote, as much a response to Portuguese activities in the Indian Ocean as a warning to Turkish authorities, end of quote. This is from Salih Özberan, who was the one who published this report in English. There's also a couple of earlier publications. Salman starts his report with a list of Ottoman-controlled leftover Mamluk ships stationed in Jeddah, guns available, the war supplies needed, and argues for equipping and using the ships against the Portuguese threat. He then describes various places in, quote, the Indian provinces that the infidel Portuguese have captured, end of quote, and begins this with Hormuz, which he includes in these Indian provinces. Turning back to the Red Sea, he provides an account of the province of Yemen, which he says is more flourishing than the province of Egypt, and it has no ruler. And this is a theme of lack of governance, and therefore a justification for takeover. And he also talks of Suwakin opposite the port of Jeddah. And you see all the sites here, right? And of course, Yemen, all of the cities in Yemen. He then turns to the Dahlaks, 400 miles further up beyond the port of Suwakin, as he says. He calls Dahlak a port of the province of Abyssinia and adds that it has exquisite pearls, but there are no seekers of these pearls there at all. Again, a rhetoric of emptiness. He continues to say that the port is empty and not functioning. He also adds that an envoy of the Portuguese with 20 infidels from the accursed Portugal, as he puts it, went there and wanted to build a fortress, but failed, and these people are still kept prisoners by the Dahlak king. Most importantly, he warns that if the Portuguese were to build a fort on Dahlak, quote, they would be able to control the sea as far as the port of Tar in the Sinai, end of quote. He then repeats that the choicest and of the exquisite pearls are fished from the aforementioned port of Dahlak, and the production of them is moreover possible and easy. Thus closing the report in a suggestive way, pushing his agenda through the notion that the conquest of the place by the Ottomans would be easy, it would also be profitable in more than one way, both politically and economically. Salman Rais's report proved prescient about the Ottoman conquest, or as Casale puts it, quote, the closest approximation to a blueprint for future Ottoman expansion, end of quote. Indeed, 30 years later, the Ottomans succeeded in establishing some control over most of the shores of the Red Sea under the leadership of Özdemir Pasha, and the conqueror of Yemen also became the first governor of the province of Ethiopia, or Habesh Eyaleti. This was an administrative province of the Ottoman realm. Although it was in Suwakin, in Sudan, and in Massawa, across from the archipelago that governors were based, the Dahlak Islands were fortified and a deputy governor was stationed there. The Ottoman ambition behind the so-called Ethiopian province was expansive in the 16th century and even later, but the reality was one in which Ottomans, Highland Christian Ethiopian kingdoms, and the Nilotic Muslim kingdom of the Funj settled into something that ranged between contained conflict and partnership, to use the terms of Indian Ocean historiography. So now we move to the second document. By the time that the intrepid traveler Evliya Çelebi visited parts of the Red Sea in the 17th century, the Portuguese were long gone from this corner of the Indian Ocean, at least as a visible threat to the Ottomans, while the Ottoman presence had become naturalized and neutralized, absorbed into local power structures on both shores. In effect, Ottoman control over the Habesh Eyaleti had faded, as shown by the fact that administrative reports from it trail off about 50 years after it had been founded. Local potentates of certain coastal places had emerged as naibs or deputies of the Ottoman pashas and were the real holders of power. In Book 10 of his Seyahatname, Evliya spends quite a bit of time describing the Dahlaks, a sign that he must have been impressed by his sojourn there, but also a standard move on his part of discursively incorporating the place into the Ottoman dominion. He speaks of administrative structures, a kaimakam, a deputy governor residing on the Dahlak waterfront, an imam who also served as a judge, a customs house. He describes the layout of the town, its commercial facilities, not much frequented, he said, in his time, and predictably, he also describes the island's pearl fisheries. It's characteristic that he also adds a section on ajaib, marvelous things he sees on the island, much in the tradition of island imaginaries, and much in the manner of medieval wonders literature, with its frequent and strong focus on Indian Ocean islands. Evliya's ajaib are a little strange, however. The goats of this place, he says, feed on the meat of mollusks out of pearl oysters and on fish both live and salted. These goats are then delicious, and their meat smells like the ambergris and the musk that comes from abroad. While clearly meant to amaze and titillate urbane Istanbulites, his audience, this piece of ajiba speaks obliquely to their having become tokens of the medieval India trade that brought spices and Eastern luxuries to the Mediterranean. It also speaks to the intensely maritime environment of the islands, where maritime pastures were a crucial aspect of subsistence, and the economies of land and sea merged. Evliya also implicates the islands in the glorious Islamic past. The islands, he claims, were conquered in the era of the Prophet Muhammad by the Caliph Uthman with 100 vessels that had sailed from Jeddah. Never mind that this runs contrary to what is attested in early Arabic sources. Evliya is intent on including the islands in early sacred geography and topography. The Caliph Uthman's force had included 1,000 early associates of the Prophet, Evliya says, who were all buried in Dahlak, though their tombs are not preserved. Just in case anybody went to check, there are no tombs of Ashab there. Evliya goes on to mention two more conquests of the islands, a Christian Ethiopian one and the Ottoman one by Özdemir Pasha in the 1550s. With this triangulation, early Islamic futuh, Ethiopian Christian presence, and final Ottoman conquest, Evliya connects this distant and tenuous part of the imperial realm to Ottoman Islamic legitimacy and the Ottoman state's pedigree as a defender of the faith and a continuator of the heroic age of Islamic conquests in the 7th century. Evliya has one more thing to say about the Dahlaks, which brings us full circle to the contemporary island story that we started with and to the question of island language. At a different part of the book, of Book 10, where he talks about his African travels, he muses about African languages that he ostensibly encountered in the part of East Africa that the Ottomans never actually controlled, the lands of the Sultanate of Funj. He claims that the language there is actually, and let me give you a little bit of that area right there, right there. He claims that the language there is actually Hebrew, and then compares that Hebrew with the language of the Dahlak Islands, which he says is also a kind of Hebrew, and it's called Dahlavi. There are many remarkable things about Evliya's persistent identification of southern Nilotic languages with Hebrew, or what Robert Dankoff has called Evliya's linguistic exoticism. But the part that interests us here, that we have time for, is that he identifies a distinct language of the archipelago. Is this the same Dahlak observed by modern linguists, Simeon Senel and Idris? If so, Evliya's reference thus pushes the existence of this idiom back to the great traveler's time in the 17th century, and most likely even earlier. Evliya says Dahlavi is a version of Hebrew. The linguists say it's akin to Tigre. In a certain sense, Evliya and the modern linguists agree. This language is distinct and yet familiarly connected. Simeon Senel would also add, has also added, that Dahlak is the native language of an island population characterized by multilingualism. with Arabic, Afar, and Saho also spoken. And some of the evidence that I very briefly presented today, I hope, has shown that people of many different ethnicities and languages passed through the islands, and several of them lived on the islands. Linguistics thus seems to offer one more key for the history of the archipelago as a place in between, but at the same time, a place connected and a place of its own. To sum up, when the Southern Red Sea emerged as a flashpoint in Ottoman-Portuguese struggle for domination over the Western Indian Ocean, both sides sent fleets through the Bab al-Mandeb and planned for confrontations. The Portuguese drew careful maps of bays and islands. A mature example of this tradition is perhaps visible here, the exquisite Queen Mary Atlas by Portuguese cartographer Diogo Romain, where the islands are drawn in spectacular detail and with demonstrable care. The Ottomans stayed longer and more systematically, included the islands in an administrative structure of empire. Both were newcomers to the scene. The Ottomans may seem more familiar strangers, but as South Arabian chronicles show, very clearly, they too were considered outsiders in the area. Islands in the region took new significance for these 16th century newcomers, who saw these islands as bases to exploit and fortify. Exploitation of recognizable marine resources also appears in the earliest programmatic and exploratory documents of these ambitious outsiders. Of the long list of actually available Red Sea resources, only the flashiest and more lustrous, meaning pearls, attracted outsider attention and visions of direct exploitation. Whereas earlier tensions over resources had certainly existed, and earlier larger states had claimed dominion over the islands, the nature of the relations consisted in symbiosis and dependence on the local rulers of Dahlak and on the maritime services and resource extraction performed by the Dahlaki islanders themselves. In the age of contained conflict, both Portuguese and Ottomans attempted in real ways to take over island space and even fortify it, but they did so with limited results. In response, this new situation appears to have produced shifts in the local island polity, including the phenomenon of the reappearance of the Dahlaki Sultan, or of a Dahlak Sultanate, that, as we have seen, is first attested in the idea of the Sultanate is first attested in the 11th century. But the outsiders' totalizing and globalizing ambitions eventually faded, and local and regional concerns took over, governed by the changing climatic conditions of the so-called Little Ice Age and the connected concerns of polities on both sides of the Red Sea. But that's a later story. Thank you for your attention.